Hello from Midori House in London. Welcome to Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up today, we'll travel the route that liberated Europe 75 years ago. We'll take a look at art that focuses on the experience of organ donation.
Having inherited the deceased organ of another person who I'll never know, I believe that I also inherited the trauma of their death.
We'll talk to the owners of one Italian restaurant that's bucking a rather depressing trend, and also...
There are paperback book fairs and secondhand shops where they do crop up, but most of them are missing from the major bookshops. We're talking about popular authors of the 20th century, people who were selling in their millions and then literally vanished.
The authors now largely forgotten. Plus, a detailed look through the weekend's papers. All to come in the next hour, live from London on Sunday Brunch here on Monocle 24. Let's begin, because later this year, a series of events will mark the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the Allied landing in France in 1944 that saw Allied forces begin the process of liberating Europe. Well, now to mark that anniversary, a new guide's to be published later this year, charting the route that they took. It's called Travel the Liberation Route. One of its authors is Joe Staines, who is with me in the studio now. Now, we should say this book's not available yet. It's coming out later, as in July, I think.
I'm hoping that it actually coincides with the anniversary of D-Day.
So that'll be beginning of June.
Yes. So June the 6th is the actual day of D-Day. And I'm expecting the book to come out just before then.
So... tell me back to the beginning of this. Where did the idea come from?
Well, there's an organisation called Liberation Route Europe, which is based in the Netherlands, and it basically coordinates with lots of partner organisations a kind of international memorial trail, specifically in Western Europe, commemorating the progress of the Western Allies through Europe in 1944 and 1945. And so its partner organisations are things like museums, war cemeteries, but also, tourist organisations that organise tours. And they approached Rough Guides. Liberation Route Europe have a big website with lots of history and lots of contacts to their partner organisations. And they approached Rough Guides, and Rough Guides have produced not the book of the website, but an independent book very much tying in with the aims of Liberation Route Europe.
Because people will know D-Day, as you say, June the 6th. People will know the final Liberation Allies marching on Berlin, the end of the war.
Yeah.
What they may not know as well is what happens in between those two moments.
Right. Well, I suppose that it's a kind of extraordinary picture of... an approach on Berlin from the East and the West, from the Russians, or the Soviets as they were then, in the East, and the Western Allies, which were the Americans and the British, but also the Canadians and all the Commonwealth forces and all the armies from the occupied countries like the Poles and the Czechs, all coordinated under the supreme command of General Eisenhower, starting in Normandy and sweeping through to Europe, aiming for Berlin. So there's a series of countries, and the book is organized in chapters. So each liberated country has a chapter of its own, which basically outlines the progress of the liberation, also, sketches in what happened in the preceding years before liberation, in other words, life under occupation. And then at the end of that section, there's a series of recommended sites within each country. So, as I suggested earlier, museums, war graves, actual sites like the beaches in Normandy, etc., which you can visit.
And now, presumably, there are an awful lot of stories. There are an awful lot of events along that route that you can't get them all in the book. So you have to choose which things to guide people towards.
Yes, That's absolutely right.
That process must be fascinating. You must have read a lot of stories and think that's interesting, but it doesn't quite make the cut.
Yes, and you're sort of limited in how, you know, what do you balance? Do you want it to be predominantly about military history, or do you want it to be as much about the experience of occupation and what it was like for the people to be liberated? And I think what's interesting in terms of the history is that each country memorializes these places in different ways. And of course, the other interesting thing from a British and an American perspective is that, of course, we weren't occupied. We weren't liberated because we weren't occupied. And I think sometimes British perspectives on the war fail to take into account just how hideous it must have been to be occupied, and to a certain extent how difficult it would be to be liberated. Because, of course, in Normandy, where it all, as it were, kicks off from the point of view of this book, where does the liberation start? Different historians say different things, but we're starting, in fact, with Italy before and Normandy. But northern France was absolutely devastated by Allied bombing in the preparation for the Operation Overlord, D-Day. And, you know, a city like Caen was pretty well annihilated by the Allies. Yes, for good reasons. You know, they wanted to wipe out the Germans, and they wanted to, you know, destroy the infrastructure within France that would enable German supplies to Normandy. But it caused absolute devastation.
So it makes it much more complex when the people who are, you know, as you say, on paper, are liberating you,
yeah,
but have destroyed your home in the process.
Yes, and I think there are different stories. So I think, you know, British and American and Canadian soldiers, as they marched through Caen, were probably a little upset that there weren't sort of cheering crowds coming out. But they'd, you know, a lot of civilians had to evacuate and were living in sort of caves outside the city. Whereas when they reached Antwerp, when they liberated Belgium, there was absolutely euphoric, you know, greetings, and it was extreme celebrations, and which went on. So it varies, and the other fascinating thing is how these countries, how much investment they've put into memorializing these places. So recently, the Poles, for instance, have spent enormous amounts of money building brand new museums, very much kind of state-of-the-art museums, whereas the Czechs haven't. I personally find that really, really fascinating. So in Gdansk, there's this very, very grand museum dedicated to the Second World War. But there are lots of new memorial sites in Poland, hardly anything in the Czech Republic.
There is this phenomenon, isn't there, now, and I suppose this book is a part of this idea of sort of remembrance tourism.
Yes, that is essentially what it is. And I guess that's important because we're coming to the point in the 21st century where a lot of the people who are actually active participants in the Second World War are reaching the end of their lives. So I think it's important that these things are commemorated. You know, some people argue that there are risks involved in, as it were, fetishizing that kind of period of our history. But I think it is really important that it continues.
So this it probably is a way, perhaps, of one of the things, you know, I mean, I hate the way that most conversations end up discussing Brexit these days. But one of the things that people particularly get irate about is you'll hear sort of a passionate Brexiteer say, well, we liberated these countries and now they're telling us what to do. And there is this sense of like, well, if you knew a little bit more about all of this, then you might not rush so quickly to invoke something so catastrophic.
Well, I think that is a very interesting point. And I think Brexit is germane to this story. And in fact, I was a waverer. The referendum, I wasn't utterly convinced. And actually what swayed it for me was I happened to be in Berlin and visited a church that had been not completely, but very, very heavily damaged in the war. And they'd turned it into a kind of commemorative site, and there were sort of, you know, sculptures and crucifixes with bits missing, looking like sort of damaged humans. And it kind of, and I think what people sometimes refer to as the peace dividend is absolutely crucial. And as we see authoritarian regimes doing so well, not just in, you know, in Europe, places like Hungary and also Turkey, not to mention Trump in America, an increased movement towards sort of right-wing authoritarianism, I think it's incredibly important that we, you know, talk to each other and work together rather than, you know, separate ourselves. And of course, things like the United Nations and indeed the European Union grew out of the you know, the post-war situation.
I know that I read one person said that we have been lucky to live in this period of relative stability and peace in Europe and kind of assumed that it would just go on forever. But if you were to look at the last 2,000 years, actually, this sort of 75-year period historically starts to look like a bit of a blip.
Yes, it does. And and it's pretty terrifying, really, I think, the situation at the moment. So I think it's incredibly important that, and people are very interested in it. So a lot of these sites are absolutely burgeoning and growing up. There's an interesting issue also around who we've included in the book. So the only two countries that were liberated by the Soviets, the only two countries to be included are Poland, because it's so crucial, its story, and Czechoslovakia, now the Czech Republic, because, of course, from the point of view of Liberation Route Europe, yes, the Soviets were liberators who immediately became oppressors. So that's been quite a tricky one to get the balance right, because if you look at things like, if you look at it from a statistical point of view, the UK losses and the American losses were about 500,000, speaking fairly roughly. The Soviets lost between 20 and 26 million people in the course of the war, which is an astonishing amount. And of course, they were invaded by the Nazis. But of course, as they came into these countries, into Poland, into Czechoslovakia, you know, they basically took them over and they became satellite states and, you know, had a regime inflicted on them that was, if not as oppressive as the Nazis, pretty damn close.
You say the book hopefully out around the time of the anniversary of D-Day on the 6th of June. It sounds absolutely fascinating. Best of luck with the final months of preparation. And thank you very much for coming in to talk about it this morning.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Joe Staines, and that book, A Travel, The Liberation Route, will be out later this year. Stay with us. Next up on the programme, art that explores the story of organ donation.
Funny how many people get these things wrong. I go into a lot of jazz clubs and I go, what made you build it like this?
These days, everyone's got an opinion about design. Join us on our journey to cut through the noise. We sit down with the design greats.
It's just bloody-minded inquisitiveness, really.
And have you covered on everything from architecture to product design and fonts to fashion?
There's so many collections being designed. Actually, there maybe is a lifespan on a designer's role at the helm of a brand.
And of course, we're at all the key events in the design calendar with in-depth reports from our global network of correspondents.
2.5 hours by train from Amsterdam lies the historic city of Maastricht, which every year hosts the fabulous TAFAF Fair.
Perhaps intuitively, Monocle on Design is Monocle's weekly design show. Tune in every Tuesday at 1900 London time or download the podcast on iTunes or Spotify.
Well, next we're going to look at an exhibition that's on here in London and explores organ transplants and tissue regeneration. It's called Spare Parts. Among those involved, John A. Douglas, whose work Circles of Fire Variations is a video installation based on his own experience of getting a kidney transplant. He spoke to Georgina Godwin.
I was initially diagnosed with renal failure in 2004. I was then on dialysis for probably close to 7 to 8 years. And I was very fortunate. I got the call for a transplant in 2014. If I hadn't received that transplant, I would not be here today. So I'm extremely grateful for the donor family. I don't know the donor. It was a deceased donor. So ethics in Australia is such that you're not allowed to know the donor family. In 2014, I really started to go downhill. I had a feeling I wasn't going to make it that year. And the doctors kept telling me, oh, yeah, you're going to get a transplant. It's coming, but you don't know until the day you get the call. And it's pretty amazing when it happens. It's like, it's really hard to put into words. And I think making these series of works has been not only a great thing to do for my practice, because I've been very successful at doing it and very successful in getting funding to do it, but also it's actually, I believe, like other artists with chronic illness and disability, I think it's also giving me a better quality of life, and I also believe longevity as well.
So tell us about this particular piece of work. It's a video installation. It's called Circles of Fire Variations.
Yeah. So, of course, I've had the transplant. The transplant was very difficult. It was a near-death experience. I stopped breathing on the table. I have a lot of other complicated medical conditions. And I was recovering in ICU, and I'm thinking, okay, I've had the transplant. Now I've got to think of an idea for the work. And this vision in my mind just kept coming to me. It was almost like a Dantean, which is Circles of Fire kind of has a Dante kind of thing about it. I just kept imagining that, and it must have been the image in my mind of the near-death experience of being plunged into a pit of fire. And also around that time, there was a Circle of Fire or Ring of Fire eclipse. So that's how I got the name Circles of Fire. All of my work is centered around performing in landscapes, and I work with a choreographer and I do performance, live performance, but also video performance, and you'll see both of those at Science Gallery, where I try to articulate through movement what my experience is of the various events in the transplant process. So the two-channel video that you'll see in the exhibition is divided into chapters, and I kind of loosely structured it around a narrative template of Dante's narrative template. So there's basically 9 circles. So it begins with the call, then entering surgery, near death, immunosuppression, and then finally the last sequence is called boot camp. Now, I needed to find a landscape, and I thought, well, volcanoes are kind of really difficult to shoot, and they're very difficult for me, having just had a transplant, to figure out how to get there and perform. And I discovered a crater, incidentally, which was called the Gates to Hell, in the middle of the Karakum Desert in Turkmenistan. So that was a whole other story, because it's not very easy to get into Turkmenistan, which is kind of a former Soviet, still like a Soviet state. But I was able to go there and video and perform on the crater, and then I did a whole lot of other pieces. I also wanted to have a water element in the work, so I was fortunate enough to have permission to shoot at a place called the Spotted Lake in British Columbia in Canada, which is one of the most sacred sites in North America. It's basically a lake covered in circles of different coloured pools, but it's also a healing lake. So coincidentally, there was also an early Persian fortress outside of Ashgabat in Turkmenistan called Nisa, which was the site of the world's first hospital and also where the world's first medical texts were written. So I had all this amazing coincidence happen around the work, which as the work evolved, I incorporated into it. So you'll see in the video me kind of relentlessly doing this walking performance through the hallways of Nisa, on the Spotted Lake.
Now, the exhibition as a whole invites visitors to question whether spare parts, that's in inverted commas, can exist outside the biological body, or whether our bodies can be a sum of independent parts that are regenerated, enhanced, donated, or altered. And I wonder what you think about that.
It's interesting because my understanding is quite different to that. So I guess my work is exploring the emotional, psychological experience of the transplant process. And for me, the idea of spare parts is sort of an old Cartesian view of the body, which I don't really have. One of the things I do believe is that having inherited the deceased organ of another person who I'll never know, I believe that I also inherited the trauma of their death. And that plays into part of the emotional and psychological and cognitive problems associated with transplant. But also, in terms of just pure science, I also now share that person's DNA, which I find really fascinating as well. And a lot of transplant patients will often talk about, you really are a different person. You quite change, not just by the fact that, you know, you've been able to extend your life, but in some ways, there are very strange personality shifts and people start to like things that they didn't like before. It's a lot of shared commonality with other transplant patients. I think John Wynne and Tim Wainwright's work looks at that, where they interviewed transplant patients.
And just finally, I mean, you've explained how it works and what it's about, but if one was just to sit in a darkened room and watch it, what is it we're going to see? You moving across the landscape?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a kind of allegorical, operatic video performance piece. I'm very much influenced by cinema. So, for example, my surgery sequence, I partially appropriated some of the aesthetics of that from a Ken Russell film from the 1980s, a short film called Nissen Dorma, which was part of an anthology of films called Aria, and that was the aria from the opera. And he used jewels, like coloured red jewels, for a woman that had had a car accident and the surgeons sewing her up. And I thought that would be a great idea to, because I totally wanted to steer away from the transplant experience being literal. I call it a kind of visual poetry of, because the whole experience of being in hospitals is actually really quite boring, and there's a lot of waiting, a lot of time you're just sitting there wondering. And so all of it is about transforming that experience into some kind of visual, poetic, operatic form.
And that's John A. Douglas, one of the artists involved in Spare Parts, Rethinking Human Repair. It's running at the Science Gallery here in London. It starts on the 28th of February and runs through until the 12th of May. You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. We move on now to our weekend read, where we hear every time from a different author about their latest work. This week, it's Christopher Fowler, the multi-award-winning author of more than 40 novels and short story collections, has even also released his own Christmas pop single. His work, The Book of Forgotten Authors, looks at some of the names from literature that we've forgotten, as he explained in a conversation with Georgina Godwin.
It was a long gestating project that really started when I looked at my parents' bookshelves and then realised a lot of those authors were no longer available in bookshops. So I started compiling a list of them and rereading them and finding new things in them. And there are paperback book fairs and secondhand shops where they do crop up, but most of them are missing from the major bookshops. We're talking about popular authors of the 20th century, people who were selling in their millions, and then literally vanished. So I became interested in whether their books were still relevant and good and interesting, and actually what happened to those people.
Mm. Why are some authors just forgotten? Why do they go from million sellers to zero?
The biggest single reason is falling from fashion. So we have a lot of books written in the 20s and the 30s, which are now pretty unpublishable because of their social attitudes towards women, certainly racial problems in those books. Normally gay characters go off to the library and shoot themselves. There's a lot of that. So if one republishes those books now, they need a little bit of a preface explaining the milieu in which they were set and the time in which they were written.
Yeah. I mean, I laugh because it's so unthinkable that that kind of thing would be published these days.
Yes. I mean, look at Agatha Christie. They're still constantly published and they're filled with references to swarthy foreigners and fast women.
Mm.
And we sort of overlook that with a little bit of a laugh now.
So whittling this down to 99 authors must have been pretty difficult. How did you get there?
Well, there were 450. My editor and I sat down and we had to decide. He said, you can't have 450 of these. You're going to overwhelm people. So we got into huge rows about who comes and who goes from this pile. So I started off deliberately, provocatively, with Marjorie Allingham, who still has her own society, is republished constantly. And I said, well, yes, but a lot of people will know her name, but they may not have read her. And that became a criteria. If you know the name vaguely, but you don't quite know what they've written, that's a good argument for inclusion.
Mm. Now, there are a few essays dotted throughout the book. You start off asking why good authors are forgotten. Then you talk about the forgotten Disney connection. What's that?
That's a very interesting one because Walt Disney was very keen on European literature. And most of his animated films were based on rather obscure European books. And he made them very successful again. You think of films like The Swiss Family Robinson, which was a very popular book in Switzerland, hence the title, which became a huge, huge hit at the time and changed the lives of many authors because he republished them.
Now, we were talking about Agatha Christie, and of course, she's a crime writer that still endures, but The Forgotten Queens of Suspense is another section.
Well, what you tend to get is one person dominates each era in that particular type of book. So Agatha Christie defines crime in the 20s, Sherlock Holmes defines mystery in the 1890s, and the other ones all tend to get pushed aside and rather sidelined. So putting that section in was a way of bringing some of them back.
Mm, because you also have a section on the rivals of Holmes and Bond and Miss Marple.
Well, yes, there are some wonderful, very similar sort of heroes and detectives by other authors who deserve as much recognition. Gladys Mitchell's Mrs. Brady is like Miss Marple on steroids. She's fantastic. She's very cruel. And in one book, she's described as having the features of a pterodactyl having just taught its young to eat their first donkey.
We're talking about why books are forgotten, but I'm quite interested in the other side, why books are suddenly incredibly popular. As you say, Miss Marple on steroids, but it was the books about Miss Marple that got the sales. Why do you think some books and some authors just suddenly grab the zeitgeist?
Well, there's a theory about Harry Potter, which is quite interesting, that the first Harry Potter book sales, which were very much reader-driven rather than the publisher, coincided with the peak of the divorce rate. And the idea is that fathers were reading books to children at night for the first time. And this is just a theory, but it's kind of an interesting one because nobody ever really defines what plucks something from the blue, unless, of course, obviously it's a publisher deciding to spend a huge amount of money on a particular book. And that often happens where they burn their fingers on that book.
Or there's a movie tie-in.
Well, the movie is the big one. I do wonder whether Stephen King would have been as famous if his first book, Carrie, hadn't been made into a movie by Brian De Palma and become such a huge hit.
Or somewhere, even more recently, somewhere like Andre Aciman and Call Me By Your Name, suddenly his book sales are soaring. But that's, I would think, I mean, he's a very good writer, but it's the film.
It's being plucked out of there. And Stefan Zweig with The Grand Budapest Hotel. I mean, I had never heard of him before I saw the film. And then I immediately downloaded all of his books.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of people did.
Talking about downloads, I wonder how that relationship now between sort of something in print that's easily kind of just doesn't get republished, and if it is available in a digital format, that must make a big difference.
It does make a huge difference, and it's changed a lot in the course of writing Forgotten Authors, because when I started it, originally, there were only a handful of the titles were available. And I didn't want to make the book too obscure. I didn't want them just to be full of strange names that people didn't recognise. It was very important to have tangible memories from those authors. But in the time of its gestation, many of them have come back as ebooks now.
It's amazing how digital does drive all of this. So in all of these 99, is there one for you that absolutely stands out that you think should have a whole new iteration?
Oh, well, there are several. Bridget Brophy, definitely. I think she's really coming back into fashion now because her ideas on gender, particularly women, were so far ahead of their time. But I would have to pick Polly Hope because it was a mystery for me to find her. She wrote a book under a pseudonym, and I couldn't track the book down anywhere. I had it as a teenager. The book was called Here, Away From It All. And Polly Hope went missing. I actually put a call out through the Independent on Sunday looking for her. And one day I got a handwritten letter saying, I understand you're looking for Polly Hope. Look no further. I am she. Come to dinner. So
oh,
I did. And we became great friends, and the reason why she had suddenly stopped writing was because she was designing the Globe Theatre.
That's amazing.
Polymath.
Yeah, Polly Hope, the polymath. With all of these writers, you talked about finding out what's happened to them since. I mean, obviously some of them are dead, but have they stopped writing mostly, or they just kind of went into obscurity?
Many continued, but just to no acclaim. So the peak book, the one which everybody loved, becomes the peak of the career, and then they write about other things. Often I think writers become more complex in their thoughts as they continue writing, and the very clear, simple thoughts that they put down in their first or second books, the ones that capture the public imagination, they move on from, and they become richer and better writers, but they don't necessarily take their readership with them.
This is a book, as it says on the back, quote from Styler, says the perfect guide to finding your next reading obsession. And it really is that, isn't it? So you have a couple of pages on each of these authors, and you describe their work. It's a wonderful way into literature that one possibly may not have found.
Well, I was trying to make it more of a tantalizer than a biographical list of authors to be read. I didn't want it to feel like a chore. And just to tease with enough of a story, both about the author and the books they wrote, to encourage further reading.
Absolutely. I now want to read everything that's described in
Not here. Everything. There's a section at the back for justly forgotten authors.
Yes. And who makes it there? Who's the top of your list?
Oh, Vivian Holland, Oscar Wilde's son, who wrote appalling doggerel. And there's some very, very bad poets. And then some very verbose people who wrote thousands of books that went completely unnoticed because they just were driven to write badly for a very long time.
And that's Georgina Godwin speaking to Christopher Fowler, and his book, which is called The Book of Forgotten Authors, is out now. Don't forget, there's a full back catalogue of all the Meet the Writers episodes at monocle.com. Stay with us in just a moment. We'll take a look through the weekend's papers.
The rolling hills of Somerset might not be the most usual spot for a world-class art space, but it proved to be the perfect fit for Houser & Worth, an international art gallery with its heart in the countryside. Monocle Films reviews a weird and wonderful show that looks at our relationship with the land.
We used to base our knowledge, our experience of the world, on the land, on nature, on the other beings that shared the world. Now we don't. So I'm trying to, in a way, re-establish a relationship to a form of knowledge that could be useful for us.
Somerset's Strange Fruit, playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
Well, now it's time to take a look through some of the stories in the weekend's papers across the world. My guest in the studio this morning is Cornelia Mayer, who's the CEO of Mayer Resources, which is a business consultancy. Thank you for coming in this morning. Lots to talk about. We'll start with something we've referenced a little earlier in the day, this big security conference that's been taking place in Munich. Mike Pence there for the US. Angela Merkel having a bit of a go back at Donald Trump?
It's in the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is a very, very good... It's actually a brilliant piece of journalism, this thing. Merkel basically says, well, look, Mr. Trump, we understand you're concerned about security, but we are concerned about the INF Treaty, and could we please maybe also include the Chinese to speak about intermediate nuclear weapons? Because for the Europeans, for the continent of Europe, and also for Britain, suspending the INF Treaty is really dangerous, because this is where you know, a rearmament will take place. So we will be one of the battlegrounds. She also says, look, I mean, if a security concern for you is that BMW produces cars in the US and employs people, then I really don't quite get it. And she says, and you tell us we are too lenient on refugees. Well, we took in 1 million refugees. We helped stabilize, and we helped make the sort of the Eurasian continent, or sort of from the Middle East to France, a safer place by doing that. And then Pence obviously countering, saying this is the biggest delegation that he has ever brought, and, you know, huge exaggeration, as they do, on how wonderful his economy is doing and how much secure we are. It was interesting. It was also interesting, which is not in this paper, but I saw it on the television, that Nancy Pelosi attended, and she got a standing ovation. So Europeans are not quite with them. And they also, obviously, there's the Iranian issue, because Pence had on the 13th, 14th of February, he had a go in Warsaw at his conference on the Europeans not subscribing to the sanctions and their payment channel, because, as you know, the Americans withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal, and Europe says the world is a safer place if we keep Iran engaged. And also, we are sovereign nations. America cannot dictate us what we have to do.
And as I say, he reiterated that again during this conference of the weekend, that he wants the EU signatories to the deal to pull out as well, which they're obviously not going to do. Is there a sense, though, that, you know, Angela Merkel replaced now as leader of her party, not that much longer as chancellor? There's a sort of liberation, isn't there, when you know that you're not going to have to run for election again, to start telling truth to other people?
Yes and no, but I think Merkel is just really, she's sort of really had it with Trump, because Trump has had so many goes at her. And I think throughout the political spectrum, I mean, they can't agree on anything in Germany, but these three points, they all can agree on, whether they're social democrats, not the AfD, not the extreme right, but even some of the extreme left of the Linke could agree with some of this. So I think there's a broad consensus in Europe. Macron is also subscribed to it. Even Britain, we are close to the US, but the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, we still think it's a good idea to stay in.
Now, one story that's attracted a lot of attention in Britain the last few days is the issue of British teenagers who fled to Syria and Iraq to join the Islamic State group. The Times newspaper managed to track one of them down. It says she's about to have a baby and wants to come back. And then the other newspapers have been following on with this. You've got a story in the Telegraph.
Yeah, I have two. It's actually two stories. It's on page one, which says, what are we going to do with the 800 plus jihadists who are coming back? And that's really a problem. What are we going to do? And then there's a whole thing on should we bring Shamima Begum back? And also just, you know, what will happen once the caliphate, the ISIS caliphate, the Daesh caliphate implodes? Because they will morph into something else, and they may be even more dangerous for us here once they've morphed into something else. I was a bit dismayed. I'm a huge Sajid Javid fan, but I was a bit dismayed when he said, oh, we should just not let her come back. Well, you know, if she has a British passport and no other passport, we can't really take the nationality back. We make her stateless. That makes her even more dangerous. So it's probably better to let her come back and deal with her in our legal system, which, suboptimal as it may be, is something. But that is really it's an issue. How should society deal with these people who when they come back? How can they turn them around? Interestingly, and it's not in this paper, but In the sort of mid-2000s, the Saudis had a good sort of re-education program after 9/11 for these jihadi people. We should think of how we can, you know, turn them around.
The difficulty, I suppose, if you're Sajid Javid, is the politics of it, is that there's an editorial in the Telegraph today, actually, that complains that politicians still don't want to accept that the public has got a different opinion on Brexit to them and won't accept it. But if you're Sajid Javid, then you, even if you think maybe well, we can bring her back and we can find some way to keep tabs on her at all to combat this ideology, you know that the overwhelming majority of public opinion is that they shouldn't be allowed back into the country.
But here I beg to differ with you, because surely if you're a Secretary of State of Her Majesty's government, maybe you want to consult with lawyers before you make statements like that. I'm not a lawyer, but I'm sure they're very clear when you cannot take away nationality from somebody is clearly delineated in a whole body of international law. And before you make a statement, if you, especially as a Home Office Secretary of State, you have access to the best and the brightest of the lawyers. Surely you could maybe consult them?
And it's something, I know that Donald Trump's been putting Britain and a lot of other countries under pressure to take back people who are currently in US custody, who are accused of involvement in some of these jihadi groups, and say, well, it's your responsibility to deal with them. And Britain's position has been to, in some cases, that it wants to withdraw their citizenship.
Well, yeah, I'm not a lawyer, but I think it's easy to withdraw citizenship if they also have another citizenship. But you get into a whole legal quagmire, if they only have British citizenship. It's not that easy to make somebody stateless.
We can't ignore it any longer. it's time for the regular feature on Sunday mornings that we've started to call Brexit Corner. What's this weekend's Brexit?
It's I must say it's madder than a box of frogs, but sadly it's not a box of frogs, and it's really important. Well, the Times starts, the Sunday Times starts on page one with May's unity plea is shattered by leaked WhatsApp messages. So she sent out this letter to everybody saying, look, get behind my Brexit deal. And obviously, some people say it's 80, some people say it's 100 members of the European Research Group, the hardcore Brexiteers under Jacob Rees-Mogg, are not united with the rest of them. And she is so true blue that she sometimes puts party a little bit before country, because surely one could maybe find a coalition, a cross-party coalition, to support a deal. But this defeat that she has just suffered last on the 14th, on Valentine's Day, what a present on Valentine's Day, makes it also harder for Brussels to give in, because they say, well, you know, does she have a mandate? Can she get anything through Parliament? Why would we give in?
One article this week talked about how that the problem that the Remain supporting or the sort of soft Brexit supporting side of the Conservative Party has is that they don't appear to be as fanatical as the Brexiteers are. So if you're Theresa May, you know that group around Jacob Rees-Mogg are actually willing to destroy the party, are willing to jump off the cliff and take you with them if necessary, whereas the people on the other side of the debate who would like a softer Brexit, who would like to work with the opposition, always seem to step back from those kind of confrontations. So in the interest of party unity, she has to go with the Brexiteers.
Well, but it's not about party unity, really. She's the Prime Minister. It's about the country, I would argue. And there's a very good piece further inside the, I think it's 14, 15 on the Sunday Times, which talks, there's also an interview in there with Tony Blair, who says, well, you know, who criticises also the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn for not having, for not being more constructive. And he says it bewilders him that anybody talking to business surely must realise what a hard Brexit would mean for the country.
And indeed, Tony Blair, I think, in that article doesn't absolutely rule out coming back into politics when he's asked about
it. He doesn't absolutely rule back, but, you know, I mean, it's just difficult when people sort of these comebacks. You know, people are getting older and the country is getting younger But you know, the interesting thing is, do we want to have a second referendum, which May rules out? Are we going to go into a general election? I mean, what are we going to do? And how do we as a country look to the outside world? Because if I'm Europe, I'm going to say that these people can't make up their minds. And, you know, we've negotiated in good faith, but nothing seems to take.
You have to have a certain sympathy with the Dutch government, who launched their Brexit information campaign this week with a giant blue Muppet called Brexit. Just seemed entirely appropriate. Let's move on to the New York Times, which over the weekend has taken on a fairly significant issue, the future of the entire planet.
Yes, well, it has on page one. It's this the sort of, there's a lot of more left leaning. What happens when you have a very right wing president? You know, react force gives counter force. So there's a last election, a lot of more left leaning, especially members of the House of Representatives have been elected and re-elected. Like Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, and what they call AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They basically have this climate new deal, the Green New Deal, which is really way out there. They want to tax everybody, like 70% tax if you're above a certain threshold. They want to make air travel nearly impossible. It's just very, very radical. And Nancy Pelosi, again, we mentioned her again, who's sort of more mainstream Democrat, said, Green what deal? It's not very realistic, and it ties in nicely with the thing on the with a little blip on the FT page one on the climate striking students. And this is all good, and I'm really glad we are worried about the planet. Although I would like to see a little bit more of a dose of realism, in the sense, be it politicians, let's also talk to the physicists. Let's also talk to the people who can tell us what is possible. We are soon going to be 8 billion people on this planet, and these people need energy. And yes, we need to wean ourselves gradually away from fossil fuels, but we can't do it instantaneously, because our societies will collapse, and more importantly, we will deprive a lot of people from access to energy. And Energy for All is even a UN initiative. So I would just argue that it is great to think about these things. It is important. We had 2 weeks back the UN warning on global warming. A warming warning, and this is all very important. But we will get further if we have a dose of realism, and we don't just let the pendulum swing back and forth from Trump more coal to Ocasio-Cortez saying no flying.
Just briefly before we end, the death over the weekend of Andrew Levy.
Yes, it's a very, very good obituary in the Financial Times. And you know, she has been a trailblazer, and they call her a trailblazer. Her making was really she's written 5 novels in 15 years, and her making was when she got the Woman's Prize in 2004. Her parents were from the Windrush generation. So she talks about, she was a Jamaican growing up in this country, belonging but never quite belonging. And she writes about all the dilemmas that brought with her. And I think for a lot of people of color, her work is very, very important work.
It's a fascinating bit, well worth reading. Cornelia, thank you very much for coming in this morning. You're listening to Sunday Brunch from Monocle 24. Well, finally today to food. It has not been a great time for some of the big Italian chains here in the UK. Prezzo and Jamie's Italian have both seen significant closures. Caldisi's is a different story, though. The business there is thriving. Now, how come? It's a question put to Katie and Giancarlo Caldisi.
It's a mixture of things, of course, like every problem in life or every success in life, it's a mixture. One of the most important things is if you look at hospitality and you look at the raw essence of hospitality, friends of yours come to dinner tomorrow night and they can tell you that they're gluten intolerant. They can say that they really hate coriander. And you can look at the weather and you can think, actually, it's pouring with rain and it's really cold. So within 24 hours, you can cook them a meal that's completely personal to them. So you can cook a lovely stew or something like that without gluten, without coriander. In a small restaurant, we can react quickly to what's going on around us. I think if you're a big chain restaurant, it might take you up to a year to put a new line on your menu. And you can alter the pricing by offers and things like that. But we can reprint our menu within a day. We can completely change things if we want to. So our reaction time is really quick to everything that's going on around us. And I think that's one of the beauties of having a small business.
Giancarlo, you're obviously Italian and have grown up steeped in this wonderful culinary experience, I want to call it. Tell me about your evolution then into a business from this.
I had restaurants since 1986. So therefore, I've had plenty of time to make a lot of mistakes and learn along the way. One of the things that Katie mentioned is very, very true, because when you've got a restaurant like last night, I was at Bray working and people wanted the different plate of pasta, which is fresh, we make it, and they want something else in a dish. For us, it's a second nature. So you're basically making the customer feel at home. They come to us, why? They say, well, listen, I want the cow's liver done this way. Can you do? No problem. You want that? So there is that kind of personal service. But I also feel and realize if you're not on board, if you're not there to really guide your restaurant, it is rather difficult to make those kind of changes. So the success and why we're still there after 23 years in Marylebone Lane, it doesn't come on its own. It's forever evolving, forever changing. Not the actual footprint of a restaurant, which should offer a good quality food, a variety of food, should also offer quality food, should also offer fantastic service, ambiance, great selection of wines. This is the essence and the heart of a restaurant. And I think the industry must realize that we need to put our heart and soul into the place, and the customer counts, but the customer has to be treated like a proper human being.
I think that's so interesting about being reactive too. The number of times one's been in a restaurant and they go, oh, sorry, we can't do that. We haven't actually got lemons or order hasn't come yet. And you think, there's a Tesco down the road. You can
exactly,
do this.
Yes, yeah.
Katie, obviously Giancarlo grew up in the Italian cuisine tradition. You're not Italian, but you've gone on to open a cookery school and also to write books about how to do it. Now, I'm somebody who only learnt to cook in my 30s, and I wonder if it's like art or something. Is it something that you can learn to do, or must you be born with the creative cookery gene?
I think to be someone who wants to cook every day like a chef does, you've got to have passion and you've got to have a good palate. And I believe you're born with a good palate, you know, like a chef. So if we learn to trust our instinct in the kitchen, and whether you think, I like this, or it needs something. If you start trusting your instincts, you will be a good cook. But most of us don't trust our instinct. We're sort of worried about it, or we absolutely follow a recipe black and white. And maybe we should be putting our own twist on it. Or one of the things you can't do as a recipe writer is usually you don't say how much salt or pepper to add to a dish. When have you ever seen a recipe that says 1/4 teaspoon of pepper? As a recipe writer, we put season to taste. Actually, that's one of the most important things about cooking is the seasoning. But if we start saying how much salt is added, people will go, oh, you can't put that much salt in. You're going to give me a heart attack. An editor will say, you can't mention that much salt. Well, I'm not saying we oversalt things, but actually, if we do, a tomato sauce with 2 cans of tomatoes in the standard 400-gram cans of tomatoes in a sauce, we'll probably put 1 heaped teaspoon of salt in. And that will be divided between 8 people. It's not too much salt. But when I'm showing people or when I'm writing it in a book, they think 1 heaped teaspoon of salt is too much. And yet they'll go and eat a bag of crisps, which has loads of salt in it.
Yeah.
So better to be in control of your own cooking and season to taste. And people must taste as they're cooking, not just trust it and serve it. You know, they have no idea. You must taste the food, and then you'll be a better cook.
But you actually teach cooking. How easy then is it to teach somebody to do all of that in the proper way?
We both of us are passionate about passing around teaspoons, and in our Stefano Barella, who's our main teacher at the school, we always have a pot of teaspoons. So everybody tries things as we're going along. They smell it. They listen to the food. Giancarlo's always said that. You must listen to the food. Is it frying too much? Is it burning? Trust your instincts. Turn the heat down. Taste the food. And then we'll season it and then taste it again. And then you start to think, oh, yeah, it's so much nicer now because I put more pepper, I put more salt in. And it's just important, that seasoning, really. So you can teach it.
Right now in your restaurants, what you're really focusing on is pasta.
Yes, it is, yes. We're doing a month of a special pasta menu, and we've got lovely fresh ravioli and gnocchi and some of our favourite dishes.
I'm doing one pasta, which is a fresh fettuccine with the home hot smoked salmon. We do it ourselves. And then hot chili vodka in it. It's so delicious.
And you have a shot of hot chili vodka. It's delicious. And it just cuts so through the creamy, oily pasta with the salmon. Mm. So the two things work really well together.
So delicious.
Make our own chili vodka.
So we have this, and on the pasta or month that we're going to do, people come and choose a plate of pasta lasagna, which the lasagna that we do, it was...
Your mother's lasagna.
Yeah, La Mamam lasagna, very fresh. And the fact is that the pasta that we create from ourselves and the chefs is all from our books, which Kate and I wrote, and so it's all from the books, it's all real, and yesterday I was working with a chef to really make sure that what we learned, Kate and I learned, and what she puts on the recipe, because there's a lot of effort into that, is really respected. So basically you get the food that contains the item that says it does, and we don't deviate for what it should be. And reality is, I think we both are very proud to say in our restaurant the food is real. It's seriously real. And that means a lot to me.
Giancarlo and Katie Caldisi there. That's it for this Sunday brunch, produced and studio managed by George McDonald. Our researcher was Mariana Leclaster. It's the sessions of Midori House in just a moment. New Monocle Weekly in an hour. For now, though, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.